morning. This nice, nearly spring day. You can tell what the weather is like in this courtroom, because that's a skylight, and if it was a bright, sunny day, this room would be bright and sunny. But we have many people who will make it bright and sunny. And they're students from Prairie du Chien High School. Would they please stand?
Boy,
oh, my
big
gosh.
Group. Wow.
Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. It's cleverly entitled Court with Class. Students are invited to attend a session of the court. They're given materials about the case that they will listen to. And at the end of the second oral argument, they come back into the courtroom and meet with the justice assigned for the day and discuss the procedural aspects of the case, not the substantive issues. They might discuss how a case gets here, how a court decides a case, how the court issues its opinions, but not the substantive issues. If anyone would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. Oh, was a hand up?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. Sorry. Your hand against the white marble did not show, but Justice Crooks saw it. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I will meet with the students after the second case. To my left is Justice Patrick Brooks. To my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right is Justice David Prosser. And to Justice Crooks' left is Justice Patience Robinsack. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler, and on the far left, Justice Michael Gableman. With the introductions made, I'll call our first case, 2012-AT-2185-CR, State versus Hunt. Arguing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Eileen W. Prey. Ms. Prey.
A little strange coming from that side of the table and arguing first, but I'll do my best.
Doesn't happen often.
No, it doesn't.
The reference is that the party that's seeking a change sits where Ms. Prey sat, and the party who is defending either the Court of Appeals decision or the trial court decision sits on the right, where Shelley Light is sitting.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I am Assistant Attorney General Eileen Prey, and I represent the state. In this case, the state is asking this court to hold that if it was error for the court to exclude the testimony of Matt Venske in that he didn't send a video clip to Mr. Hunt of sexual intercourse, that that error was harmless. In other words, if Matt Venske had been allowed to testify to that isolated fact, there's beyond a reasonable doubt it would not have changed the verdict.
I understand that's your focus, Counselor, from your brief, but you are not conceding that it was error initially, are you?
I'm not specifically conceding. I do think that there's a very low level to a threshold for getting relevance in, but it also is a discretionary decision on the court's part. And so in order to find that there was error, you'd have to find that there was an inappropriate exercise of that discretion. I do think it's a very close call.
So that's why you focused on the other issue that
exactly.
If it was error, it was harmless.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
Correct. And it, with the idea that it is a very low threshold for relevant evidence.
Counsel?
Yes.
I did not look at the, who appeared in the Court of Appeals, but in the Court of Appeals opinion, paragraph 10, as a follow-up to the earlier question, paragraph 10 states, quote, "The state does not dispute that the circuit court erred by excluding Venske's testimony."
And we didn't specifically argue it. We didn't specifically concede it either.
And so that would probably correctly characterize, let me ask, does that statement correctly characterize your position here today? That statement is, the state does not dispute that the circuit court erred by excluding Venske's testimony. Is that still your position, or what is your position?
My position is that in order to find that there was error, you'd have to find that there was an inappropriate exercise of discretion. And I think that the stronger argument for the state is that if there was an error, it was harmless.
To be clear, you're not conceding that
I'm
issue.
Not conceding.
Right. So it's different than the Court of Appeals stated.
The Court of Appeals, I think, was saying, and it is accurate, that we didn't argue that it was relevant. We said in the Court of Appeals, as we said in this brief, that if it was error, it was harmless.
Oh, I see. You didn't dispute it. You didn't argue it, but you didn't concede it either.
Correct.
Is that the point?
Correct.
Okay, I get the difference.
All right. Thanks. Okay.
Okay, this is the second case within 24 hours where the state and Mr. Aaron argued one yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly the same language that you used, which is fine. As far as I'm concerned,
for the standard, you mean of harmlessness?
This is the.
Okay.
If it was error for the trial court, it was a different allegation of error. If it was error, the error was harmless.
Right.
And
okay.
We asked him the same question, and he answered similarly. I'm not disputing it, and I'm not conceding it. Mm-hmm. I'm not even discussing it as to whether it's error. We're just going to go right to harmless error. So from that, I gathered, because there's somebody in your office that reads these briefs and supposedly is going to have a, am I right? There's someone,
yes, there is.
A supervisor that reads your briefs, and that the state should be taking consistent positions, as I understand the purpose of reviewing the briefs, right?
Correct.
Okay. So I'm just checking. And so here...
I can't guarantee that that was... I wasn't taking a consistent position.
I understand. This is your brief. The language is the same.
Okay.
That's fine. You just want to talk about harmless error.
Correct.
Okay? Shoot.
All right. In this case, and because it's harmless error, I'm going to have to do a little bit of fact background that I normally wouldn't
do. Sure.
And in this case, Mr. Hunt was convicted of showing his adopted daughter, who was 11 at the time, a video clip on his cell phone of two people having sexual intercourse. The daughter at trial testified that it wasn't one image, but that he showed her three images in close succession, and one of those images was of the sexual intercourse. Now, Mr. Hunt agreed that his daughter saw some inappropriate stuff on his cell phone, but he said it was one image, not three, and that image was of a person, a gentleman's testicles that was deformed by a hernia, and that he had gotten that image from his friend Matt Venske. So, because of the, and he also said that he didn't purposefully show it to her, and that this testicle picture, and that he didn't say anything and he turned it off. So at trial, the defense put on Matt Venske, and Matt Venske did testify that he was in the habit, or at least several times, had sent pictures to Mr. Hunt attached to text messages, and that one of the pictures was of a bare-breasted woman with antlers that said, "Nice rack," on it, and he also admitted that he sent the picture of the herniated testicles. When it came to the time that the defense attorney asked him, did you send a video clip of the persons having sex to Mr. Hunt, the court on its own didn't allow him to ask that question. And the court's belief was that this was a collateral kind of issue, that it didn't really matter where it came from, that he could have gotten it from a variety of sources. He could have gotten it downloaded from the Internet, from other text messages. And I think the court didn't want to get into a mini-trial on whether Matt Bensky could send video clips on his phone or not, that it would be distracting to the trial and that it would be a collateral kind of issue. So the court on its own did not allow that testimony. And it's questionable whether that was a correct ruling because of the low level of relevance. Mr. Hunt argued that it was relevant to his defense, which was that he said he showed, or at least she saw, a picture of the testicles, not a picture of two people having sex.
Counselor, one thing that occurred to me as I was reading the briefs, and I didn't see it, but maybe I missed it, did anybody get the cell phone and just subpoena it and look and see? Was there anything on it?
They did, and it was all erased. There were no images.
Well, it wasn't on. You don't know. Do you know that it was erased?
He said, okay, there was nothing there except for in the address book that Matt Bensky's name was in the address book. And so nothing was there when the state got a hold of it. I don't think they could see whether it was deleted or not, but Mr. Hunt had testified that he deleted things right away and didn't show. So that's where I'm coming with the deleted.
Okay,
photos.
So that there were none of the images that she spoke about were there?
None of the images she spoke about or the testicle picture wasn't. The jury saw none of that. Nobody saw any of
all
that.
Right. Thank you.
So, our position is that even if Bensky had been able to testify and we're solely looking about this one question that he was going to be asked, which was, I guess, two, really. One was whether he sent a video clip to Mr. Hunt of persons having sex, and the other was whether he had the capability of doing that. Our position is, for a variety of reasons, that wouldn't have affected the verdict. First of all, I think the credibility of Mr. Bensky would be highly questionable because he agreed that he sent sort of questionable stuff attached to text messages on repeated occasions to Mr. Hunt.
But as far as the relevance goes, Counselor,
yes,
as far as I can see it, and I'm sure your opposing counsel will address it, I see its relevance limited somewhat to the idea of presumably, Bensky would have answered no, that he didn't send it. And so, therefore, the defense has now eliminated one person in the world
right
from having sent this video.
Right.
And so, so the probative value of that information, I think you referred to it earlier, is relatively minimal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just trying to think, and I guess by my comments, I'm inviting your opposing counsel, which I'm sure she's going to do anyway, to address if I'm missing anything or if there's any more probative value to the question and to the purported answer.
Yeah. I do think it was a very low probative value. I think they had the defendant saying that he got the testicle picture from
sure,
Matt
yes.
Bensky. But they had that testimony from Matt Bensky was allowed to testify that he sent that picture, so they still could have the defense that he showed her or she saw that picture rather than the sexual intercourse. I think perhaps Ms. Feitwood might also say that it ties into the other claim that they had, which was that the daughter wasn't allowed to say that when he showed her the things, this is the stuff that Bensky sends me. Now, I think that is not doesn't help him very much either because, first of all, it's just the defendant telling the daughter that. Then It also, it's possible, even if she did say that, that he showed or she agreed that one of the images was the bare-breasted woman with the
yes.
antlers, and that was something Bensky showed her. So he could have showed her that and then clipped through to some the other image of the person's having sex in the cartoon image from another source. And finally, he totally disagreed that he ever said that or that he would say that, probably with the idea that it was very questionable to be showing his daughter this testicle picture. He said, I never said anything like that, and I shut down the image as soon as it came. So I don't think that that helps him very much. So I don't see that tie. But primarily, I agree with you, and it's the same reason why the circuit court decided that it wasn't relevant, that because he had set up this idea that it came from Matt Bensky, but that doesn't prove at all practically that he didn't get the image
for
somewhere
instance,
else.
When I, and again, opposing counsel,
yeah.
when I first read the first memo that came through on this case, I wrote at the top, what difference does it make who sent the video?
Yeah.
And I guess in reading all of this and in preparing for I haven't really come up with a more sophisticated analysis. And so
yeah.
I'll be interested in hearing about the probative value of who sent it.
I think that's an issue, and I think it's a big issue. And I think that they also, you had this, the daughter who, although she wasn't clear about the order of things, was very clear about what she was shown, and I think it's highly unlikely that a jury would feel like she would misinterpret seeing somebody's deformed testicles with three images, not one, three images, one being somebody having sex, one being a cartoon image of a woman flatulating, and another image of the deer rack image. I think to say that she misinterpreted one image to morph into these three images is not very credible. Then you have
that's a question for the jury, isn't it?
Excuse me. That is, but when you're deciding whether there's harmless error, you need to look at the facts that were presented and the fact that they it was really a he said she said kind of case, and they believed her and found him guilty is I think a supportive of that this slightly the evidence that's of very little probative value that was left out wasn't going to change their credibility determinations on that. And then you also have the idea that the police officer, that it was before the jury and it was admitted into evidence that Matt Bensky told the police officer that he didn't send a video clip and couldn't send a video clip. Now, I realize that wasn't entered for the truth of the matter asserted, and they can't determine whether or not he sent it by looking at what he said. But they were instructed that they could determine that that's what Bensky told the police officer. And I think that has some corroborative value as much as what Bensky would have testified personally.
Counsel, in your response, you touch upon a number of the areas that are the subject of the ineffective assistance of
yes.
counsel claim. And I would like to briefly touch upon those
sure.
just to see if, like we did at the threshold of the argument, what the state's position is
sure.
on error,
okay.
if any.
All right.
Set the framework.
Okay.
The first ineffective assistance of counsel listed in your brief is what you refer to in a heading as the present sense impression exception. And, of course, that deals with whether or not the daughter, A.H., was allowed to testify
right.
That... I think said to the officer.
She said, "Do you want to see the stuff that Matt sent
right.
me?"
She said that Hunt said,
"Correct.
Do you want to see the stuff that Matt sends me?"
Correct.
And so the argument is whether or not that's admissible under present sense impression. I'm just setting the context.
Okay.
Now, if I recall, trial counsel
at post-conviction motion, confessed error on that. What's your position with regard to error on that issue?
It's in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel.
That's correct.
So I would say there wasn't deficient performance. I'm sorry.
I appreciate your clarification. He confessed deficient performance.
Right, right. And I would say he did not use an appropriate exception. I think that's clear. I think he tried to mish together a party opponent, admission party opponent, which has to be the state in this, because he was trying to get his own statement in. So it wouldn't have been a party opponent. The declarant was the defendant. The defendant was trying to get it in. So I don't think an admission by a party opponent was appropriate. He also said something about a statement against his interest, and it would be my understanding the declarant would have to be unavailable for that. And he was the declarant. He was available to testify. He chose to. So he did choose the wrong exception.
Okay. I'm just going to go through these to get your position.
But
you are arguing.
But I do not
prejudice.
Think that constitutes deficient performance, because I think he was attempting to find an exception to the hearsay. It's in the heat of battle. He was arguing for its admissibility, and I think it's a fairly high. If you look at the transcript in there,
I'm really interested in just the framework now.
Okay,
the argument. So you know which part
right,
are you
saying?
All right.
So I'm saying
deficient?
No deficient performance because you're Monday morning quarterbacking that it didn't meet the level of deficient performance.
Yep. The next one that you have listed is regarding the admission of other cell phone images unfairly prejudiced him because it confused the jury. That's
right.
Your heading. So.
Right.
And as I recall, the trial court judge in post-conviction motion found that was deficient performance. What's your position with regard to deficient performance? I know your position.
Again, I do not think it was deficient performance.
Okay.
He put in a pretrial motion that did suggest it wasn't exactly the correct statutory site, I don't think, but he did suggest that this information was unduly prejudicial and prejudice outweighed the probative nature. And he also then, he objected every time, images rather than one image was meant, he asked for a mistrial. I mean, he highly litigated that issue.
Let me focus then the third question on the third area.
And again, I just want to make sure we know we're just now talking about deficient performance, because I think, again, the prejudice part is the stronger argument. But I've just,
the
to
third
be clear.
I'll ask it in a little different way. Is it your position that with regard to the third allegation of ineffective assistance of counsel that focuses on counsel considering strategy and rejecting adding allegations of the state to the elements of the offense, is it your position that is not deficient performance?
Oh, yes. I mean, he had a reasonable strategy there and clearly was not deficient.
Thank you.
So since we've gotten to these three areas, I'd like to kind of backtrack and talk a little bit about the prejudice area on each one of those. And first, with respect to the daughter's testimony that she wasn't allowed to testify, this is the stuff that Matt sends me. I think, in fact, Hunt was probably lucky she didn't testify to that, because it totally conflicted with his own testimony at trial. He was adamant that he didn't show it to her purposefully, that he didn't say anything to her, that he shut it off immediately after she saw it. So if she had been allowed to say, this is the stuff that Matt Fenske sends me, it would have undermined his credibility and made him out to be a liar. And I think he probably realized that showing his daughter that, if it was intentional, showing his daughter that disgusting picture of somebody's testicles, that was not something that was going to go over very well with the jury, and that it might undermine his credibility. So I don't see how that would have helped him at all. And also, even if they had believed that, and it, I think the Hunt's case now is that it helped connect it up to Matt Venske's sending the stuff that he that was shown to the daughter, it's very possible that if he did say that, he showed her the bare-breasted woman, which is one of the three that the daughter says she saw, and then he would have had to manipulate the phone anyway to get to the other images, and those other images could have come from anywhere. So I don't think that getting that, not having that statement entered, hurt him at all and perhaps helped him. With respect to the two other images that she testified to in addition to the sex video, again, this isn't even like an other acts kind of thing. It was all part and panorama, I think in Jensen it says panorama of the evidence that is was of the offense, that she is saying that he showed her three images, he is saying he showed her one image, and that was the kind of thing that needed to be in front of the jury for them to make a credibility decision. It was part of the context of it, and it was very probative in that sense to have these testified to. In addition, the court said it considered whether it was prejudicial and wouldn't have, if it had been strongly argued by trial counsel that it was prejudicial and that it overweighed the probative value, that the court would have still let in those testimony about the other two images. And finally, you have the jury instruction that does tell the jury that what he was charged with by the state and what constituted the sexually explicit conduct was the sex video of two people having sexual intercourse. And I don't think it's necessary for that to appear two or three times in the instructions for the assumptions to be that the jury found that. I know that through the briefs there was some contention that the jury must have been confused because one of the jurors asked a question. They were allowed to ask questions during testimony, and one of the jurors did ask about whether he was showing the bare-breasted woman to the younger daughter, his younger daughter. But that was before they were instructed.
Counsel, thus far, and your time I note is almost up, you have not in your argument cited to any specific statute or to any particular case in case law. So if there's any area of law development that you want to advance, I want to give you an opportunity to do that before you...
I think that both the parties really agree on the law, and it's not like we're proposing to change the standard for harmless error or anything like that. So I think this is, I mean, it's an unusual case to get before this court, but I do think it's a factual case. So, and then...
State petition for review. Why?
Well, I did say, and I think I was very clear in my petition that I believed it was a factual case, but that I thought that there had been a miscarriage of justice, and to put the child victim through another trial under the factual circumstances, that would be unfair. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Veit, Assistant State Public Defender representing the defendant, James R. Hunt. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. And may it please the court, my name is Shelley Veit, and I represent James Hunt. The Court of Appeals got this case exactly right. It recognized that the case turned on the relative credibility of A.H. and Mr. Hunt. The jury had to decide who was telling the truth, A.H. or Mr. Hunt. And because the case was a matter of credibility, the erroneous exclusion of evidence that bore on credibility couldn't be harmless. Now, I want to start by being very clear about Mr. Hunt's theory of defense, because the harm here really goes to that defense, and hopefully that will answer some of Justice Gableman's questions. So here it is. In the fall of 2009, soon after A.H.'s parents separated, she went and visited her dad, Mr. Hunt, at his parents' house. At some point, Mr. Hunt got a text from his friend, Matt Venske, and it had a picture of herniated testicles attached. It was a stupid, crude joke. And A.H. saw that stupid crude joke. So about a year later, A.H. is now a teenage girl, and she's angry with her father. She's angry at his family, and she doesn't want to visit them anymore. She takes a kernel of truth that she saw a crude picture that Mr. Venske texted her dad and blows it up into something much bigger, something criminal. Now she says she saw three images, and one of those was a video of sexual intercourse. Now, Mr. Hunt testified, and he denied the allegation. But he also planned to use the kernel of truth to expose the lie. People know from experience that's how a lot of lies start, from a kernel of truth. Now, Mr. Hunt and A.H. agreed this all got started with a text from Mr. Venske, but Mr. Venske would corroborate Mr. Hunt's testimony. He did not send him any video of sexual intercourse, and in fact, didn't even know how to send a video. And that defense that I just described to you there, that was all in the opening statement. But by the end of the trial, it was largely gone. And now, it was in part due to counsel error, in part due to court error. Counsel failed to successfully elicit A.H.'s testimony that as her dad is passing her the phone, when he's highly unlikely to expect future litigation or criminal charges, he's saying to her, hey, look at the stuff Matt sends me. And then the court erroneously excluded Mr. Venske's testimony that he did not send Mr. Hunt a sex video and that he didn't even know how to send a video. Now, at this point, I want to focus on the court error, and I want to look at the state's arguments that the error was harmless, even in this case that was all about credibility, and even though we're talking about evidence that would have helped the jury find Mr. Hunt more credible. The state talks about Officer, I think it's pronounced Nautigal, Officer Nautigal's testimony about what Mr. Venske told him, as if that can corroborate.
I'm sorry. Your timing light was a bit off, and I signaled that you had already used at least 5 minutes. So you may proceed, counsel.
Thank you, Chief.
Sorry for the diversion.
No problem. But when Officer Nautigal was testifying about what Mr. Venske had told him, the state objected to that evidence, and the court sustained the objection. And the court essentially ruled that it couldn't corroborate what Mr. Hunt testified to because it specifically ruled that the jurors could not use it as evidence that Mr. Venske did not send a video of sexual intercourse to Mr. Hunt. And now something I want to do here, because the court's instruction, it turns out, was devastating to the defense, and so I want to quote it exactly. If somebody wants to prove that Mr. Venske did something or didn't do something, they either need to have a witness who saw him do it or have Mr. Venske come in and testify himself. And then the court wouldn't let Mr. Venske come in and testify himself about the matter at issue, the fact that he had not sent Mr. Hunt a video of sexual intercourse. The court's instruction essentially invited the jury to make an adverse inference from the fact that Mr. Venske did not testify that he hadn't sent that video to Mr. Hunt. And one other thing I just want to point out about the instruction, the state at various times has at least suggested that there was some questioning and answering before the state's objection, but the court's instructions to the jury went far beyond just the question that drew the objection. He was talking about all of the officer's testimony about his conversation with Mr. Venske. He was referring to the conversations with Mr. Venske. And I'll give you one more complete quote from the court's instruction there, because I do think this is very important, and it's a point that the Court of Appeals picked up on. The court said, when the officer is being allowed to testify about this conversation, it is not to be used by you to determine whether Mr. Venske actually sent something from his phone or not. So that corroborated nothing. That helped the defense not at all. The state makes just a few other arguments in an attempt to meet its burden that this error was harmless. First, it points to Mr. Hunt's own testimony. But again, you know, I can't reiterate enough, this case was a credibility battle. evidence that would have made it more likely that the jurors would find Mr. Hunt credible can't be harmless, and it certainly can't be cured by Mr. Hunt's own testimony. The state's other couple of arguments are really very similar. The state looks at arguments that the prosecutor might have made if Mr. Venske had testified. And then the state also argues that, you know, A.H. was credible. And I could certainly stand here and debate whether I think those arguments, I think that there may be better arguments on the other side, but I think it's important that this court is not a second jury. That's a line from the Nieder case from the United States Supreme Court. And it's not this court's role to determine who was more credible or to determine which argument might be more persuasive to one jury or another. We're looking at the harmless error test here. And the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there is no reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the result.
What's the difference between these harmless error test where the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the error is harmless, and the ineffective assistance of counsel test, where the burden is on the defendant to prove that not only was the counsel ineffective, meaning standard below a reasonable lawyer, but that this was prejudicial, that the ineffective assistance of counsel was prejudicial. You got prejudicial and harmless on both sides. One defendant has the burden of proof, the other, that's Strickland, and the other, the state. So, but is it both the same harmless error?
They are very similar standards, Your Honor. The Strickland prejudice, obviously the most obvious difference is the difference in the burdens.
Right.
The Strickland standard is generally not articulated as a beyond a reasonable doubt standard, but it is hard to sort of parse out the exact words and say how they differ precisely, because they even occasionally use the same language of reasonable probability, and a reasonable probability is a probability sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome. And so other than to say
they both rely on Chapman?
They do. I go back to Chapman, yes. Yes, Your Honor. So if there are no further questions on the first issue, I'll start turning to some of the ineffective assistance.
You said that the daughter was angry at the father. Is that disputed? How much did that come up at the trial?
The daughter did testify to that, I believe. Certainly the mother testified to that in discussing some of the, you know, relational issues that the victim's mother testified about that. And then also the fight, it's never really clear exactly what the fight was about, but it apparently initiated with a fight between A.H. and her grandmother, that is Mr. Hunt's mother, that got started at a camping trip that they took. And so his mother also testified about certain issues, and among other things, she talked a little bit about the argument they were having there and about how the day before, I believe, A.H. and her mother went to the police, A.H. went and visited Mr. Hunt and his mother, and there was a continuation of that argument between A.H. and Mr. Hunt's mother, and then also A.H. and Mr. Hunt.
Counsel, as perhaps a segue to where you are intending to go, the ineffective assistance. Page 16 of your brief, you indicate really a trilogy that of items that present what you call a, quote, strong basis for acquittal. You say on page 16 of your brief that it is the, I guess, omission of A.H.'s recollection. That recollection is she was prepared to testify that her dad said that essentially, hey, do you want to see some of the stuff that Venske has just sent me? Close to paraphrasing. That's A.H.'s recollection. Combined with Mr. Hunt, the defendant's testimony that he never had that video clip. And Mr. Venske's excluded testimony, and that is that he never sent the video clip, and he doesn't know, and his telephone isn't capable of sending a video clip, that that's what presents a strong basis for acquittal. Is it your position you need all three individually, or do these stand separately? Do they stand separately, or do you need them three combined?
I think that the first issue can stand separately. I think, again, the Court of Appeals got it right. I think the first issue on its own, the state can't meet its burden of proving that that was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. However, I do think that these pieces of evidence, as you can really tell from my initial description of the theory of defense, it's hard to describe one without the other because they were all pieces of a puzzle that Mr. Hunt and his defense counsel were trying to put together at the trial here. And so I think if there's any question in this court's mind as to whether that initial issue itself is harmless on its own, then I think you do need to at least go further into the ineffective assistance claims, and particularly into the first claim. The state has argued, well, if you don't agree on the first thing, you can just remand everything back to the Court of Appeals. But I almost think that you can't fully understand the court error in this case, and you can't understand the harmlessness completely without understanding that first issue. That's not to say that you need the first issue to find that it's not harmless, but it helps for a full understanding of the defense. And again, if there's any inclination that it's not harmless, looking at these two issues together, which the court is capable of doing, I think you can see that the court error and the counsel error, there really is no question that was incredibly harmful, and it essentially deprived Mr. Hunt of his entire defense. Now, one other point I just want to make on the first instance of ineffective assistance is the state is now saying that they're not necessarily conceding error, and I guess I haven't accused them of conceding error explicitly. However, by not arguing that there was deficient performance until, I believe, the reply brief in this court, I think that error was conceded. However, I don't think there's any question that counsel was deficient on that point. And this is
that
not...
That point being what point?
Sorry. Not providing the court with a legal basis for admitting A.H.'s testimony that counsel knew was important. He had talked about in his opening statement. We're not talking about a heat-of-the-moment trial decision. We're talking about a statement that was, there's no question it was hearsay. It's one person testifying about what someone else said out of court that the trial counsel knew ahead of time was important to his defense, mentioned it in the opening statement, and then when it drew an objection from the state, apparently he had not thought of the clear legal basis for admission. And for what it's worth, it's the first subsection of the statute with the hearsay exceptions. Instead, he talks about statement against interest and then makes a few other statements that don't really relate to any particular exception. That is deficient performance. Counsel essentially agreed that his performance was deficient there, and the circuit court also found that his performance was deficient. And then, again, because for all of the same reasons that the Venske testimony exclusion was harmful, the exclusion due to counsel's error of A.H.'s testimony was highly prejudicial. Essentially, you lose those two pieces of evidence, and the defense broke down. Now, the second and third claims of ineffective assistance of counsel are distinct from the court error in the first issue, but it's sort of interesting that we have these four issues that look the way they do because they are also closely related to one another. Those are sort of two pieces of a different puzzle, and that is that A.H., anytime she was talking about what her father had shown her, was always talking about three images in rapid succession, a seamless description of what happened. She wasn't really putting one over the other. All of these images grossed her out, and every image was something that I think most people would feel like was inappropriate to show a child, and was very crude. And the charge that we were looking at is a charge that's about the image itself. And so it was very important that somehow this issue either be kept away from the jury or be clarified for the jury. And that's why in talking about prejudice on this issue, it's almost like if the second one had been fixed, then there would be no third one or vice versa, because if the court had excluded the first two images based on defense counsel providing the court with a reasonable legal basis for excluding those images, rather than talking for 20 pages about how it thought the court had already ruled that way, which just wasn't true under the court record here, if he had excluded those images, the problem would be resolved. However, if, as the state believes, the circuit court had found, no, those images were critical to the context of what's going on and they couldn't be excluded, well, then if counsel had made sure that the jury, in considering the elements of the crime here, knew that it couldn't consider either of those first two images because those images couldn't form the basis of the crime, then we wouldn't have such a prejudice. But when you look at these two claims together, you're left with a situation where it looks like he really didn't get a fair shake. There may well have been some serious confusion among jurors about what they were thinking, about what they were looking at, because no one had told them that they had to tie the elements of the offense to any particular image or not consider any particular image.
Counselor, I thought opposing counsel just said exactly that, that the jury instruction said that it was only the image of sexual intercourse for which they could find him guilty of a crime. Is that not correct?
No. When the court began reading the jury instructions, he talks about what is in the state's information. And there's a clause in talking about the state's information where it says, you know, it charges the defendant with this crime, and then specifically looking at a video of sexual intercourse. But then it goes on to give all the standard jury instructions, and then it gets to the elements of the crime. And when it got to the elements of the crime, that's where the court had initially proposed, the court raised the idea itself, we need to make sure that the juries are clear on this. It proposed making the same sort of clarification there, because that's where you're telling the jury how they find whether the facts meet the elements of the offense. The defense counsel didn't want it, and his reasons for not wanting it are a little idiosyncratic, a little odd. The standard jury instructions are the jury instructions. That is the way they're supposed to be. And then also he didn't want to remind the jury of the images that they had seen. But again, we're talking about a crime where that is what they're looking at, and where the complainant in this case, A.H., had never singled out a single image. She had always talked about them, again, as sort of a seamless succession of crude, inappropriate images. And so his decision didn't make sense in that context. It also leads to, you know, one possibility in this case, in talking about just the underlying fairness, and that is the jury did find that A.H. was not credible on one very serious matter, and that was her allegation that Mr. Hunt had sexually assaulted her, which leads you to wonder, wow, how could they find that she was not credible on something that weighty, but was on this issue? Well, the mistakes that go to the second and third claims of ineffective assistance of counsel might explain that, because Mr. Hunt himself admitted that for a year he had the deer rack, nice rack picture on his phone that he used as his cell phone's wallpaper, its screensaver, and that at some point his daughter had seen that. So you can see how the jury, confused about the nature of the charges, given the evidence that was presented in the case, could have found A.H. to be not credible, and yet Mr. Hunt guilty of the offense.
One of the jurors asked a question of the defendant, as I recall, regarding the picture of the topless woman and the deer antlers. And that question asked by the juror, I think, was, did you show your other daughter that picture?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is there any other juror participation with regard to that image that I have missed? Or
no, that's the only question that came up about that. And, you know, it is hard to see why the juror would have asked that question unless the juror thought it was important for some reason. And I'll note that there was no juror question on the sex video, on, you know, whether that had gone anywhere. So somebody was thinking about the Dirac picture. Obviously, we can't speculate on what happened in the jury box. But, again, I just want to point out one last time before I go, if there are no further questions, that this case was all about credibility. It came down to who does the jury believe, A.H. or Mr. Hunt. And in the end, it doesn't matter who we believe or who this court believes. It matters who the jury believes. And evidence that went right to credibility and evidence that might have made it more likely for the jurors to find Mr. Hunt credible can't be harmless in this context.
Let me ask one question for clarification, if I may. I did not read the entire trial transcript. Did the jury have before it the picture that Matt Venske said he sent with regard to a hernia?
No, nobody admitted the hernia.
So the jury didn't have any of these images before it, in part because the jury didn't have any of these images or purported images in front of them. Is that correct?
That is correct. Thank you, and we would ask you to affirm the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Bray.
Thank you. Just a few things. The jury was instructed that, very specifically, that the second count of the information charges that between such a date, the defendant did commit the crime of causing a child to view or listen to sexual activity, specifically a video clip of a man and a woman engaging in sexual intercourse. To this charge, the defendant has entered a plea of not guilty, which means the state must prove every element of the offense charged beyond a reasonable doubt. So they were instructed as to that. I do not think there's any law that the assumption that the jury follows the instruction means that you have to repeat something two or three times in an instruction. It was there. And the reason why the counsel believed that was the best place for it is because that is where the instructions talk about the factual underpinnings for the charge. The statutory elements, he felt that that was an appropriate place to add that language because it may have confused a juror into believing that that it relieved the state of the burden of proving that the sexual video actually constituted sexually explicit behavior. And I think that's rational. With respect to the juror asking questions, that happened during testimony. That was before they were given this specific instruction. So I think you can't go rely on that at all. There were no questions from the jurors. There were questions, but not relating at all to what images were in contention after they got instructed and were in their deliberations. So I think, and a final point on the instruction area is that if you read the closing arguments, they do say images from time to time. The only image that is explained in any detail that is what it constituted was the sexual intercourse. It's very clear to me when I read the closing argument that that's what everybody was talking about. Everybody was on the same page with respect to that. So I think there was very limited possibility that anybody was confused about what he was charged with. I just wanted to clarify also one other point, and I think that maybe Ms. Feit maybe just meant misspoke, but when the officer Nottigall testified about what Vanskia told him, that testimony actually, the objection was overruled. It wasn't sustained. That testimony was admitted. Now, it was admitted for the limited purpose of determining who said what to whom, and it couldn't be used for the truth of the matter asserted, but it was admitted, and it, as admitted evidence, it was relevant to something.
And did the court give a specific instruction emphasizing that it, or instructions, plural, emphasizing it, that it couldn't be used for the truth of the matter asserted?
Yes, and it was right after that testimony. It wasn't like the end instructions. There had been a lot of objections on hearsay. This is a very strongly litigated case. Sometimes you look at trial transcripts and there aren't many objections. This is objection after objection. So the court felt like it needed to give some sort of instruction on what hearsay is. And then the very specific instruction was that you couldn't use it for the truth of the matter asserted. And so you couldn't use it to determine that Vanskia actually did not send the video, but you could use it for the point that he told a police officer that he couldn't. And I believe if it has any relevance, and it had to have some relevance because it was admitted, that the relevance was in corroboration of Hunt's theory of defense.
How do you explain this or respond to this catch-22 that the court apparently instructed that it's not evidence that Vanskia actually did not send a video?
Right, I twisted it.
I know.
I'm sorry.
That Vanskia, the court instructed, would have to come in and testify it to himself, or someone would have
or
to.
Or somebody would.
With personal knowledge, that's right.
I think.
But the catch-22 is, then when Vanskia was going to testify that he did not send the video clip and his phone was not capable of downloading such a clip, that the court precluded it. So it's kind of a catch-22, it seems. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think that the point that the court was trying to make is there had to be, in order to for them to make a finding that indeed happened, that he didn't send the video, there had to be some direct testimony to that, and Hunt had provided that direct testimony that he didn't receive that from him. So there was some evidence in the trial that there was direct evidence that Vanskia did not send it.
So Hunt, you said Hunt corroborated his own testimony.
He gave the direct testimony. It was corroborated by the statement of Nottigall that was told to him by Vanskia, is the way I look at it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Justice Prosser.
May I ask?
Question.
The charge about exposing a child to sexually explicit material. The date in the, is it the complaint or the information, is between September 1, 2009 and June 30th, 2010. Is that right?
Correct. And that is another reason why Vanskia's testimony isn't all that helpful, because nobody could pinpoint when exactly this happened, and so whether or not Vanskia sent him something, he couldn't say that, and he wasn't asked, actually, whether that was the only thing that was sent at this particular time. He was never asked that, and whether he could even kind of pinpoint when he supposedly sent this testicle picture. I'm not sure. So to me, it undermines Hunt's case that there was no specific date that they could pinpoint when this happened.
But testimony was excluded that the date was the date that Matt Vanskia sent something.
That wasn't excluded. He wasn't asked that, but there's no indication he couldn't have been asked that. It just was not asked.
Was
it was never pinned down when the three things that the child testifies to. It was never pinned down at what date this happened the 9 months.
The closest they came to was the fall of 2009.
This was charged in the fall of 2010?
Correct, I believe. It was at least a year later, yes.
It was the testimony of...
Bradley?
Thank you, Chief. Was the testimony of the daughter excluded, that the source of these images came from Venske? In other words, if there were images, they were sent from Venske. Did that remain in, or was that excluded?
What was excluded was her statement that her father told her, this is the stuff that Venske sent. There was some other testimony, again, from Officer Nottigal that didn't get objected to, that she had told the police that that's what, that it, the stuff apparently came from Matt Venske.
Are there any other questions? If not, I want to, on behalf of the court, thank you, Ms. Bray, and thank you, Ms. Fite, for arguments once again on exclusion of evidence and harmless error in criminal cases. That concludes our argument in 2012 AP 2185 CR State versus James R. Hunt. The court will take a brief recess so the students may leave. Other students are waiting to come into the courtroom, and I will then call our second case. We are in recess.